Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We need to spend more money to rebuild manufacturing, but it ain't successful before 5 years. You can't just make factories out of magic. You have to build buildings out of something. So either we get free energy tomorrow, cold fusion, right? Or we have some way to become miraculously productive, or aliens land and say, we want to buy all your stuff.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. And today, very, very special guest. We are going to be discussing gold and silver and banking and the big bubbles that are going on right now and where everything is headed. These are going to be some really fresh insights. You're going to want to tune in with this. Vince Lancy, welcome back to the program. So good to be talking with you again.
Thanks for having me back on, Chris. I appreciate it.
So many places to start. Target-rich environment right now. But, you know, the last time we talked, I'm sure people remember, we were talking about the flows of gold. There was all this craziness. Gold was flowing from London to New York and all that. It seems to have settled down. Just tell us what's going on in the gold and silver markets, because gold's gone sideways, more or less, since that conversation.
4 months, I think, almost now. You're right. Well, since when the U.S. started taking gold back, I think that's when we talked last, what it was like in the beginning of that. And in the meantime, China was still buying gold and taking delivery of it. You had basically two straws sucking the gold out of Europe, you know, to the U.S. and to China. And what it really did, I mean, this is almost an aside, but what it really did is it showed the fragility and the unreliability of the LBMA as an institution, as a steward or custodian of the West's wealth. In terms of gold and silver, and we could do it again, but I think we're done buying for now, or we're done repatriating for now. And I have my suspicions as to why we're doing it and to what ends. That's forward looking and a little bit tinfoil hat, but so far tinfoil hats have worked. With China, you know, I was getting a little worried. All right, there is a chart. I don't have it handy, but I will give it to you if you want to show your viewers. I got this chart 2 weeks ago, and it was a very nice breakdown of nations buying. So each color, orange, blue, when the U.S. buys, when taking delivery out of Switzerland. And I noticed, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole yet, but I have to say this. I noticed I was looking for patterns in the buying. So when the U.S. was buying, when we were buying, we talked last time, what was China doing? And I was like, well, China's not buying much. And I went, okay, fine. So it was stable. And then when the U.S. stopped buying, I said, well, China's not buying either. That's bad. And I looked. I went, oh, China's buying again. And mm-hmm. So it's almost like a yin and yang situation, which leads me down the rabbit holes. But for now, I just want to say that the China institutional central bank and off the books, not off the books, but OTC buying has surprised me. And it has surprised Goldman Sachs and has surprised other banks. And what I mean by that is they expected it to tail off rather dramatically in 25, but it did not. It tailed off, but not as much. And the tariffs may have something to do with that, but the urgency is still there. Now, that's the surprise. What I knew was coming, but didn't know it would be this strong, would be that Asian ETF investment demand is real. It's not like American, oh, the dollar's down, let's buy gold. They're just buying it. They're just like, we need to buy it. And they've been, China and other countries, primarily China, have marshaled their population to buy gold like we're probably marshaling ours to buy crypto. It's not a FOMO item yet, but that's the idea. So that's the first thing. The first thing is I was surprised at the buying has gone from government to retail, but it's not the speculative retail. It's the invest. It's China. I mean, it's not hot money. You know what I mean? Even active, these are conservative Confucian people, you know? So there's that. But in between the official Chinese buying and the retail buying at the bottom, that those were the two surprises. In between, what I was counting on, and I wasn't disappointed, was the corporate institutional buying out of China. And now buying is insurance companies. Now, the insurance companies, although we don't have to... Yeah, I'm sorry.
No. I just read about that were they going to take 1% of their assets and put it into gold, apparently?
Yeah. They are. It's actually fascinating for viewers as old as me or even as old as you. But what China's doing is they want to encourage culturally gold to be held. And one of the ways they're doing that is they're really pulling a page from what Ronald Reagan did in the 80s, not with gold. In the 80s, your older viewers may remember, Reagan kind of deregulated the stock market and encouraged insurance companies to create variable annuities, right? 82, 86 with the tax change. And that was one of the reasons that we had the explosion in stocks in the 80s coming out of the recession, the stagflationary era. Now, what they're doing with gold is it's like, practically speaking, at the investor level, while Chinese bonds are yielding whatever, 1%, 0.5%, we need to give people insurance product, life insurance product, that's going to give them more than that. And so China said, put them in gold. And I went, oh, okay. And it was, we covered this at Goldfix. When it was announced in, January of this year, or earlier, and it was covered, we covered it extensively. I was reading the translations of the Chinese characters into English. And what the West was picking up on was this. Especially the banks, China's doing a pilot program. They're not sure. They're testing it out. And I'm like, no. That's not how China works. It's like any real company. You don't launch it until it's ready. There's no beta testing in China. Beta testing means it's a done deal. So when they said, the actual lines were like, we want to paraphrase what you said. Let's say there's 500 insurance companies. I don't know. We want our 12 biggest insurance companies to put up to 1% of their assets into it. And people reading that as, oh, it's 1%. And then Bank of America and the other better banks in terms of quantifying the risk, because they're just front running their own trades, right? They said, well, this equals that amount of dollars to gold. And I went, okay, that was a good reference point. And then I started reading the characters in the English and the various translations, and I went, this is a mandate. It's not a recommendation. It's not a test. It's a mandate. So it's like when you say to your child, your bad child, you say, I'd really like you to get that cleaned up today. That means get it cleaned up or you're in a lot of trouble. And so the Chinese central authority is saying to the insurance companies, I'd really like you to have at least 1% by this date. And sure enough, that buying has materialized as well. Now, that's harder tactically. It's harder to see how that buying works, but it's kind of like this. They don't buy until they have product lined up. So I have 5,000 people that are interested in this. So they start to take inventory. And this is manifested with China ETF buying, that's your retail. U.S. ETF buying, it's not really there yet, but it's growing. You have the central bank buying, which is still surprising, even though it's not big right now, it's there, still surprising. And you have this insurance buying. And these are the three cohorts of buyers keeping the gold level up here, right? Peace is broken out. What do we get, $15 today? You know, okay, big deal. You know, like we're trading 3,400. We're still in the middle of a $200 range between, say, 3,250 and 3,450. And you look at this, you say, is it toppy? And then, no, there's real buying. Now, but I won't change gears yet until you want me to, but there's also selling in the market. That's why I'm enthusiastic. It's not just buying and us going, it's not going up, it should go higher. There's selling in the market. So this market is finding a home at 3,350. And I like it. And we're not even buying yet.
No, we're not even buying it. You know, I just, one of the ways I do use AI is it does some structured math. And so I just did a thought exercise. I said, hey, you know, AI system, pretend that the top 10% of families have basically 0% exposure to gold, which is pretty much true on a rounding basis right now.
Right.
And so, A, how much financial wealth do they own currently? And the answer is about $120 trillion, give or take. And so the question is, well, if they wanted to move to a 5% allocation, which I would consider low, right? You know, I would think, you know, Merrill Lynch came out with an analysis a while ago, said 10% is kind of a minimum. They have a model where they said, you know, starting from 1900 to current, 20% was actually the most dominant strategy in there from an efficient market hypothesis, all that. So
wait, Merrill Lynch admitted this?
Yeah. It was like 10 years ago, but I have it. I saved the report. Yeah. You know, so at any rate, let's imagine this is just a thought experiment. So what if they move 5% in? Well, that's easy. 5% of 120 trillion is we got to get like $6 trillion has to move in. Next question, how big is the total gold investment market in the U.S.? And the answer is about $1.2 trillion.
Yeah.
So you start trying to put those numbers together, and it's just like, how does that even... Seems like a math problem.
That's a really good point. You know, you talk about people having zero or close to 0%. The funny thing is, you know, the CIO of Bank of America, just coincidentally, Michael Hartnett, he's very well known. He's a macro analyst. He is a guru. And I had been breaking down his reports for subscribers in what I do, a visual walkthrough, for almost 3 years now. And in the last year, he started talking more and more about gold. And of course, my readers are like, oh, now we like Hartnett, you know? Anyway, but that's all fun. It's all part of the game, right? But a big portion of his client book is institutional pension money. So it is the RIAs, not CTAs, these are equity people. RIAs on the equity side, it's institutional hedge fund managers, it's big players, and it's pension money. And he has a report that comes out once a month. It's called the GFMS, the Global Fund Manager Survey. So he surveys his clients. What do you guys think? What's overbought? And, you know, he discloses that. And it's sometimes it's a contrarian indicator, and sometimes it's not. And 3 months ago, these pension managers said that they thought the most crowded trade in the world for June was long gold. They updated the punchline is the best part. Long gold. So June, long gold. But, you know, we had just made the high, the tariff day. What did he have? He had a word for it. Anyway, that came out. And a revolution there, whatever he called it. And so gold was kind of hanging out up there, and people were saying, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a crowded trade. Now, the other data point is, what percentage of them had gold? Well, it was less than 2%. Yeah, it was basically yeah. Zero. Yeah. It's basically 0%. So I went, okay, but now mind you, they were saying it was overbought. So maybe it won't go down, but it's not going to go up. I got to look at that as at least... I know they're underinvested, and in the long term, that's going to bite them in the ass, excuse my French. But in the short term, tactically, as a trader, maybe I don't want to be long right now. And that turned out to be right, because we've been in a range since June for a long period of time. Now, fast forward to, what's today? Today, Wednesday?
It's Tuesday, the 19th.
Tuesday. Feels like Wednesday to me. All right, so today's Tuesday. Sunday, Michael Hartnett's weekly report comes out. And in his weekly report, he says a couple things. In one spot, he says, gold is no longer the most crowded trade. Now it's like a Mag 7 stock or something like that. He goes, and then he makes a point. This is three reports in a row, but this one he made it most big. He said, institutional investors are really, really, really underinvested in gold. They are less than 2% was his number. And he doesn't put prices on it. He's not hawking anything. He just said, look, if you believe, this is what he believes. If you believe that we need to spend money to make America great again, whether it succeeds or not, and you believe that the BRICS are also going to be spending money to build their own infrastructure, then you believe that we could have an inflationary boom. And if we're going to have an inflationary boom, you need to own commodities and you need to own gold separately. So you want to own consumed commodities and gold. And if you believe we're not going to, then you need to own gold. Basically, what it really boils down to is I'll just say it. He upped his allocations for his clients for gold and crypto. Crypto because it's an aggressive, like a tech stock, mm-hmm. and gold because it's the opposite. It's called a barbell trade. Safety, aggressiveness, and one or the other is going to happen. So when you say 0% or close to 0%, I go, yeah, we've been hearing that. And now I'm hearing Michael Hartnett say it. And I say, you know what? I think personally, this is me gaming the system out a little bit. I think personally, there's going to be a big push to put people's money into gold. And I say that because I know money has been flowing into miners. People are now befuddled. Why are miners up with gold in a range? I'm like, it's because they've been too cheap for too long and they're catching up. The banks are buying the miners. People haven't bought them yet. And so I think when they get their mining position on, then the both metals markets will start to gyrate higher in unison. Anyway, there's not enough people that are investing in gold. And I think China is dragging us into being aware of that.
Well, you know, back in the day when I was trading gold pretty aggressively, I learned real quick that I had to keep an eye on the miners because they tended to lead the action, right?
Didn't they? So, back in the day, they did. Yeah, that's right.
Yep. You know, somebody would be dumping miners and they'd be like, uh-oh, time to get out of gold. Yep. You know, it was just
XAU
a thing.
All the time. You see the XAU mining index?
Yep.
In Philly? Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if that's still a thing. I don't track it at that level of detail. I just buy and hold now. You know, full disclosure, I've been in the miners for a while, and they went nowhere for a long time. But this year they've been moving. So, but, you know, one of the things I'm picking up now, Vince, is more and more people are starting to ask the question. Who've never involved themselves in gold, never thought about it before. But they don't really, they have almost zero understanding. Like, literally, they've never held an ounce of gold, wouldn't know how to buy an ounce of gold, don't know who to call, don't know how they would sell it again if they had to, just like base right. novices. So,
I don't know what it does. What does it do for me? It's a bedrock. Mm-hmm. They've been trained to think that way. Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, but now we're starting to see a lot more charts. I don't have one at my fingertips, but just, you know, things ratioed in gold. So what are house prices in gold? What is the Dow in gold? What are barrels of oil in gold? And when you do those ratios, not dollar based, you find some interesting things like that, that if you had been invested, but it's not investing. I just store my wealth in gold, right?
Right.
I happen to have done that back around 2001. And that was a moment where the house to gold ratio was way off. Just like way off,
right.
And I just caught it at the right moment. And today, to get an average house, I would have to part with a lot fewer ounces of gold than I would have had to back in the day, because these
right.
things go in their long arcs, right?
Yep.
You know, gold protected me from inflation. That's what I think it did. I actually think the true rate of inflation was 9.8%, because that's my compounded annual return on it. If you look at it that way, I think
right.
that's fair. You look at all that. To me, gold still is primarily that. Do you think, is there some other use case coming up here with the BRICS? Could it get remonetized? I read something crazy on the Federal Reserve website where they talked openly about potentially remonetizing or resetting the price of gold.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I could speak about the revaluation topic that the Fed talked about. But I could speak about that. I wrote about that as well. But with regards to how is, just to start off with, like, I think the basic thing, if you're trying to get investors or people who have no gold exposure to understand the merits of gold exposure, I think you talk about inflation, but it's interesting because I think people, the first wave of Americans that bought it was on the bank defaults. They started to, you know, and these are related items. You know, if you have a bank default, you have to inflate. You know, if you have inflation that fails, you have a bank default. Same idea. But I think the point I'm trying to make is generationally, over two generations, we'll call it a neo-Keynesian upbringing, people were steered away from gold. They were steered away from silver. They were steered away from something beyond investing. You said the word, I'm not really investing. And the word beyond investing is owning. I trade gold and I own gold. I don't mm-hmm. invest in gold. That's what that people say. What do you mean by that? Well, I don't invest in gold because I don't expect a rate of return on gold. I'll invest in miners, but I don't invest in gold. I just own gold. I want it to be a pet rock. It's supposed to be stable when everything else is not. And that's the idea, you know? If it cures cancer, then great, then it's worth even more. But the point is, you can't replicate it, you can't duplicate it. And so it will keep track with everything on Earth in that way. The home analogy you use, the whole a suit is worth, a good suit is an ounce of gold since forever. And, you know, these are tropes or cliches or axioms. But I'll throw this out there. They're coming back. As you noted, they're coming back. They're coming back as comparative tools because you start to look at things not in dollars, but in compared to other things. If I'm going to buy this, then I can't buy that. Same idea. Now, what I want to add to that is we're seeing that concept, even though we're thinking about it, we're talking about it, it's originating in China again. Not necessarily China, but it's originating in the East again. And by that, I mean they're de-dollarizing. They're no longer looking at things in dollars, or not as much anyway. They're looking at things in how much gold can I get? They're looking at things in their own currency, yuan or rubles. But the reality is all commodities, this is speculative, it's my opinion, but I think I'm right. The first commodity to go up, discounting the future, is gold, meaning we got gold from 1,200 to 3,500, 3,400. And it's stabilizing there, knock on wood. All the other commodities are cheap compared to gold. Now, if I'm an industrialist, not just a gold bug, if I'm an industrialist, I'm saying, well, if gold stays up here this long, then other commodities are cheap, aren't they? And starting in China, it's, you know what? The ratio of gold to silver is 75 to 1 or 60 to 1, or depends on who you're talking to, Troy, like 15 to 1. And so I believe, this is my opinion, I believe the longer gold stays up here, the more likely other commodities are to creep higher to catch up with it. Gold is setting the pace for the future of all commodities in general. We haven't even started to rebuild yet. And the reason I feel strongly about this is because as I believe the price of gold is being revalued, it's a slow process, but it's happening. I believe that gold was chosen for this because it's inert, because it's not consumed, because it's non-energy. We get the price of gold up to 3,500. Nobody cares. Maybe you or I do go into Costco buying a bar here and there. Nobody's talking about it because they're still talking about tech stocks. And lo and behold, it's 5 years later and it's trading 3,500 and other commodities, silver's trading 30, oil's trading 60, oil should be trading 150 maybe. Silver should be trading, 68, 75, maybe. And I think what happens is kind of like, if I could use an analogy, I was rewatching Game of Thrones when the Ice King was raising all the people at the shoreline. I'm sorry if your audience doesn't know it, but I'm pretty sure some of them do. And I said, oh, he's gold. He's like raising all the commodities from the dead. Anyway, so as a trader, I see gold as setting the standard for other commodities. And it's perfect because you can't tell me it's based on the economy. You can't tell me it's based on use. If you can get something that's useless to 3,500 up, 100%, then everything else is going to follow it eventually. So I guess to come back to your point, the metals, gold is rallying because they want it to rally. Sounds kind of cheap and paranoid to say that, but I believe it's going to drag other assets higher. It is. In the 80s and early 90s, gold was a predictor of the market. It discounted the future. Bond traders, I'm worried about inflation, buy a little gold. Okay? I'm worried about recession, buy a little gold. And what they did in the 80s and 90s, mid-90s on, they successfully disconnected gold from its role as a canary in the coal mine for the economy. TIPS, whatever kinds of funds, ETFs, all these products siphoned off of, the big daddy. And you can't keep a good man down. And I think we're at the point in the big contratype cycle that you're talking about, where gold can't be repressed anymore. So that's it.
Well, I remember you telling me that they don't really care if gold goes up, just not too fast, you know.
That's right.
You know, just keep that contained. I'm both a contrarian and a fundamental analyst. That's just how I'm built. And so if something doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense, you know. And so I can't make sense of the silver market at all, given, you know, explosive demand, shortfalls in supplies over demand for 6, now 7 years running, if this year turns out the same, and it will. I just can't, it just doesn't make any sense to me that it's, you know, where it's at in terms of price. So I'm a trader too back in the day, but something is off in these markets now. Vince, I'm talking with more and more people who are actually really scratching their heads going, how's this happening? You know, and it turns out that there's just huge amounts of speculative money in these markets now. So what used to be noise is now the signal, right? And what used to be signal is now the noise. So yes, the price for silver really is X, you know, 36 or whatever they've got it down to today, 38. That's the price. But that's not the actual reality of it. It's just that there are, whatever, 100 paper ounces sold and consumed for every real supply-demand producer-consumer ounce that trades hands, right? So what are your thoughts on that? Is market structure, like, leading us astray here? Will it eventually get it right, or does it just carry on till it breaks something?
Market structure has led us astray. It will not break something in silver, I think, and it's already moving in the direction you're talking about. And so, speaking directly to that, the gold market, when the Ukraine-Russian war started and the U.S. confiscated Russia's assets, what we did was we told everyone they should be buying gold or owning gold because treasuries aren't as safe in terms of custodian or counterparty risk. Fine. So that's the first truism. We now know that that's true. The second thing is, see, all the gold in the world is there. And the billion ounces of gold that China has, I'm making these names up, Indonesia has stored in the COMEX vaults, well, that gold is used and leveraged and rehypothecated and shorted. So we're leading to silver, but this is about the gold is the proof of what's going to happen in silver. So when the war started, all of the Russian gold was removed from the U.S., removed from London, okay? So we rejected them on principle because of the war. Simultaneous, that happens. That happens. Like, you can't have Russian-owned bars. It's kind of the whole embargo thing. Simultaneously, all of the wealth not in the U.S. or in London said, you know what? We want our own collateral back. You saw India repatriating gold, taking it out of London. You saw Germany doing it in 2016, right? And they're probably going to do more again. And they were doing that because if it's not in your hands, it's not yours. Now, there are valid exceptions to that. But the point is, you need to at least see it, especially if you're going to start a monetary system. So now we go to the BRICS. So this concept, this deleveraging concept, there are 10 contracts spoken for this 1 ounce, you know, over in the U.S. Well, since Basel III was passed, and it's not a big deal, but when it was passed, it discouraged leveraged play. Now, leveraged players can be long. If everyone's leveraged long because they're bullish, well, then they're leveraged long. But everyone's been leveraged short, and they've been comfortable with it for a long time because it's used as a means of price suppression. The gold market, one of the main reasons it rallied, even though it was relatively orderly over the last 3 years, was because for every 10 contracts there was on an ounce of gold, now there's only 2 contracts on an ounce of gold. The market is going from financial to physical. So when you talk about, when you say the signal and the noise are inverted, that's absolutely the problem. The problem has been the West or financialization's goal is to use financialization to turn everything into a derivative or an asset, and to use financialization to, in its defense, create liquidity and facilitate the flow of the asset back and forth. So we're going to make futures out of it. And that works. And then you're banking, you say, wait a minute. IBAR from the Fed at 2%, and Chris and Vince borrow off their credit cards at 20%, and they're buying silver and gold, I think I'll just sell it to them. And so you become the whale at a poker table, constantly doubling down, and you bluff a pot every so often. And that's why silver and gold have been lower. Now, moving forward, and it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's happening. It fits and starts. Gold is no longer something that you can take for granted, that you can say, oh, I need to get some gold. I'll borrow his for my trade deal. You know, it's a shorting. That's not a given anymore. And silver is in the hopper, getting ready for its shot on deck for that. And silver's a little different in terms of the mechanism, because banks that are short gold and it gets called away from them, they have to find more gold. And you can find more gold. It's there. Not silver. Central banks can lend gold out to each other. It's kind of a little bit of a daisy chain that they have going back and forth at the LBMA. But silver, it's not sitting around. There's no silver sitting around waiting for people to say, oh, yeah, I have some silver in my backyard. I go and borrow. It doesn't work that way. It's used. So I think silver is the high beta example of gold. Gold goes up 10. When central banks are done buying gold, I think sovereign wealth funds in the East are going to start buying silver. That's it. So I think silver will go up because the Ice King is going to make it go up. And I'm not saying that hopefully. It's just mathematically what's going to happen. So there you go. I have a lot of silver. Let's put it that way.
The markets are a ticking time bomb. Volatility is spiking, trade wars have broken out, and most investors are sleepwalking into disaster. Many portfolio strategies perform poorly during times like these. At Peak Financial Investing, however, we don't gamble with your future. Our registered investment advisory connects you with battle-tested wealth managers who reject outdated models and embrace active management. Strategies proven to navigate chaos, and who aren't afraid to discuss things like the great taking or maybe the importance of protecting your wealth with gold. Without the right approach and with the wrong advisor, you're risking, well, everything. Don't wait for the crash to act. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com right now to schedule a free consultation and discuss your particular situation. Take control of your wealth before the markets take it from you. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. And I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you to act now. So in April of this year, the United States EIA, the Energy Information Agency out of DOE, came out and they completely revised their future forecast of U.S. shale oil. So, of course, energy is really important to the vitality of a nation. If you have it, you can do lots of things. If you don't have it, you get steadily poorer. It's the whole story. And they put up this chart, Vince, and they said, oh, yeah, this is future production. And it just showed oil peaking, and that's that, right? So they admitted peak oil, right, which is fine. But it just changes everything, right? So all this oil we've been exporting, so currency flows are coming in. That's going to, the tide will slowly stop in reverse course. You know, yeah. It changes geopolitics all over the place. It's like a really big deal. And oil's just languishing as if we're just going to have more of it forever. All the way out in the term structure, too, way out there. Like, you can go years out, and everybody's confident of this thing. I'm like, did they not read reports, or am I not read into the real report? Do I have different information? Like, there's such a disconnect here. I've never seen anything quite like it.
It's funny because I don't think we can overestimate the lack of motivation for people to do the right thing because of these past, say, 10 years of alternate energy being shoved down our throats. I mean, you get committed to something, you commit to it. So it's going to take time. You know, it's like, anyway, so the reliance on, I love nuclear. I understand why it's got a place. And I also understand solar's got a place. I don't think wind has a place. Hydro does, obviously. But there's nothing that's really more efficient for generating power than oil and natural gas and coal, if you want to go there. And so your point is valid, because to rebuild America, we need to rebuild manufacturing. We need to sell things overseas. to do that, we need to use more energy. So I think what we're right. I think what we're seeing right now is a for good reason. I'm not being paranoid about it. I think what we're seeing right now is we're seeing similar to what happened under Biden, but done differently. Mm-hmm. Under Biden, we emptied the SPR to keep the price of oil down, to keep mm-hmm. inflation down. Right now, we're in the process, not of emptying the SPR, but we're in the process of cutting deals, bilateral deals with countries. Russia will be the one that comes to mind most. And Russian oil comes back online. And it's, I think the market is discounting the peace and the future of oil being plentiful. Now, here's what I mean. It ends with lower prices create higher prices. But here's what I mean. The U.S., this is Scott Bessent talking, not me. The U.S., in order to get its manufacturing base back, needs two things. It needs a weaker dollar so we can sell stuff overseas while we're building, and it needs cheaper energy for two reasons. Cheaper energy means that we don't have to contend with inflationary costs for raw materials. And the second one is we believe as Americans, we can do more with cheaper energy than another country. And certainly we're going to innovate more than a country that's, you know, backwards or communist or however you want to look at it. A warlord country is going to just sell oil. We're going to take the oil and make plastic with it. You know, like that's the whole point. So two of his main components were a weaker dollar and weaker oil. And look what we've had. Trump is going around right now. I mean, he cut a deal with the Saudis, right? Here's the deal he cut with the Saudis. See, part of this I'm making up, but I'm not. This deal with the Saudis was, hey, stop selling our bonds. Keep buying our bonds. Buy more. Invest in our country. We'll let you use stable coins or whatever it is. And we'll give you a good deal, like you're trying to attract a sports team to your town. And print more oil. Print is a euphemism that I use. And the reason it works for us is, and I'm familiar with this from going back to when shale was first coming online. The reason it works for us is because the Saudis' cost of production is like $11 to $13 a barrel, right? And Russia's isn't much higher. Like they don't have all the shallow oil that the Saudis do, but they have the technology that the Saudis do, which they got from us. So when the price of oil is at 60, the price of oil is at 80, Shell is producing. All right, we're going to kill our own shale industry. We'll get the price of oil to 60. All right, and then what happens is that the price is 60 is how OPEC disintegrates. OPEC could disintegrate with the Saudis being the last ones left. The smaller countries or the countries with less technological expertise, they start cheating. They're only allowed to print 20% in the OPEC cartel. They print 25%. They pump 25%, I should say. And then the OPEC people say, the Saudis say, you're cheating. We don't want you to cheat. Stop cheating. And I'm not making this up. This is what they did in 99. They said, because you're cheating, we're going to pump more oil. Bing. And the price of oil goes down to $25. And at $25, no one can afford to pump oil and make money except for the Saudis and the Russians. I think that's what Trump does. I think there's going to be a news item. I think oil is going to crater. And that may be the low for generational is a term that I don't want to use, but it may be the low for years. And there's the reason I'm giving you that such an aggressive prospect is because in 1999, if someone were to pull up a chart in 1999, oil was trading, I don't know, let's say $20, and it creeped down to 18. And then word got out from my people on the physical side. They were telling me, they're like, the Saudis are getting upset because the other OPEC members are cheating. And I go, so what does that mean? He goes, well, what's going to mean is they're going to holler at them. And if they don't listen, the Saudis are going to pump. And sure enough, the Saudis said, you're cheating. And if you don't, we're going to pump it down to 11. And they pumped oil down to 11. And that was the low in 1999 for, you know, almost a generation until we had the negative price number. Anyway, the point is there's going to be a news event that's going to crater oil, and that will be the energy to buy because at that price, nothing can compete with it. So I'm a huge buyer of energy. I'm a huge buyer of energy, and I'm a big buyer of oil when there is a washout. I think there will be a washout. We're going to buy mm-hmm. the crap out of it.
Yeah. Yep. No, I completely agree. And I have contacts top to bottom throughout that whole space, and I'm an investor in oil wells directly myself. So I know a little bit about it, but they are dying on the vine. Nobody, if it's at 60, everybody's losing money out there right now.
They hate it. Yeah, exactly. He's like, that's right. I mean, you know, George Bush, W. Bush, he sacrificed our shale industry for the Saudis. They were like, you guys are doing a lot of shale oil and it's kind of pissing us off, you know? And he's like, okay, well, you know, I'll get them to stop or whatever. The financing dried off, the industry vertically integrated, what have you. But I agree with you. And that's only the supply side. The demand side, well, we need energy to rebuild everything. So it's going to happen.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, a lot of things are kind of, this isn't political, but under the Trump administration, I do want to talk about this real quick because we had this, a big, you know, July deficit in federal spending, second largest on record, if you can see down below. But what's catching my eye is that Social Security and retirement was $131 billion on inflow and $133 billion on outflow just for that. Of course, there's also income security down there, which adds to that. So our social entitlement programs are now cash negative.
I did not know that.
They've been cash positive for a long time. So that's also just that's structural at this point. There's not a lot they can do about that.
Right.
If a recession comes along, of course, obviously it gets worse than that. It looks like we have structural, it feels to me like the Trump administration threw in the towel, said, we're no longer worried about the top line of this thing, the debt. We're going to worry about the bottom line, the income, and we're just going to grow the income. And Scott Bessent has said as much. What do you think their chances are there? And what happens if they fail at that? That's a pretty ambitious plan, right? I mean, isn't that every president, like, we're going to grow the economy, right?
Yeah,
that's the plan.
We're going to grow our way out of it.
I've heard this before.
Yeah, you know, without being, I mean, I talked politics recently with someone, but I'm not going to do that now. But what Trump did is, I'm not going to say it's predictable, but it makes sense. He came in and he said, I need to spend more money. This is Tim talking to himself or to Scott. We need to spend more money to rebuild manufacturing. And we just do. I'm going to see if I can cut discretionary spending somewhere. And on top of that, I'm going to spend more. So we get Powell to lower rates. That'll make it a little bit less costly. I get some entitlements cut with this DOGE idea. And then we take the extra money. We spend it on, you know, building factories again. That's simple, right? Well, DOGE doesn't work out. It can't work out. I mean, it's easy to say it now, but I was cheering for it. But it can't work out because it's a litigious environment. You can't just fire people without getting pushback for right or wrong reasons. And sure enough, that's what's happening. I almost feel like, and you know, I'm not saying it's happened this way, but I almost feel like, okay, we'll try and do cuts. And then there's these third rails, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and, you know, these are untouchable. You can't get the cuts. You can't get meaningful cuts. And then you go, I mean, metaphorically speaking, Trump goes, I tried. We can't reduce. So now we have to go over the top and spend our way out, which is doable. And possibly successful within 5 years, but it ain't successful before 5 years. You can't just make factories out of magic. You have to build buildings out of something. So either we get free energy tomorrow, cold fusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or we have some way to become miraculously productive, or aliens land and say, we want to buy all your stuff. Because there's nowhere else to sell it. There's no colony. You know, the other thing is AI and data centers. Related, but not the same.
I've been talking about them a lot because of the energy and the water demands of them specifically.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, that's the bubble conversation we have to have, I'm sure. But, you know, the proponents of the AI and narrative are as follows. They'll say, one of the things we need to do to grow ourselves out of this, to get manufacturing back, is we need to be more productive. So we need to have a better return on capital. We need to have lower cost of labor. And AI will do that. And my response, and it's not just my response, people smarter than me have this response, is and what are you going to do with the unemployment rate at 10%? That's where UBI starts. So we're no longer in a situation where unemployment can balance at 4% and inflation can balance at 2%, not that it ever could. Now, inflation balances at 5% and unemployment balances at 6%. So the whole thing has to go off because we're breaking eggs to make omelets. And that's the situation we're in. There's no way that you can hit a switch and overnight be productive again. We've outsourced our productivity to other countries for 30 years. And this is what scares me. And this is comes back to energy a little bit. When you're a country who doesn't have the manufacturing capacity and you want it, but you don't have it, and you have to sell things to offset your losses, right? I've got to borrow $1 billion. No one will lend me $1 billion. I need to sell $1 billion worth of stuff. What do you sell if you're not making stuff? Anything that's not hammered down, anything that's not nailed down. You sell oil, you sell soybeans, you sell rights to companies, you sell pieces of equity in the country. You do what an emerging market does. You do, dare I say, what a banana republic does. You start to run your business, you're a fundamental analyst, right? You start to run your business from a cash flow point of view, not from an earnings point of view. You start to say, I need to make my nut. I need to make this money. So it's no different. It's very similar to how a cash-strapped third world country will say, well, I don't really have enough time to build a factory. I'll just sell the oil to someone else. And so we become in a negative spiral going from we're trying to focus on the long-term earnings, but we have to focus on the short-term cash flow. And if we don't have the cash flow, then Social Security, that's negative cash flow now. Social Security goes negative. Medicare goes negative. You've got to make cuts. Where are those cuts going to come from? I don't know. Who are we going to borrow from? No one. So these situations necessitate us monetizing whatever's not hammered down. Do we have Steinway pianos we can sell? Well, they're not American. Gibson guitars. We'll sell Gibson guitars. They're American. We'll sell Levi's. So we'll just sell everything to make our monthly rent. That's what we're doing now. And until the manufacturing is done, meaning it's up and running and people want to buy the stuff from us, you know, let's say the manufacturing, I'm going off here. Let's say the manufacturing, the buildings were we were ready tomorrow. You think China's going to let us sell to them? No. The market's closed unless they have a deflationary collapse. China, the world is split. There's an iron curtain financially, you know, between us. It's not my phrase. It's a good phrase, though. An iron curtain has gone up financially. We put it up between the East and the West, and they put up their own. And so even if we had all that manufacturing, I'm just giving you the very pessimistic point of view that says everything that I'm saying to you leads to this conclusion. When we're done selling all the oil, all commodities go up. Even if we're not done selling the oil, demand makes it go up. We're rebuilding supply chains. They're rebuilding, they're creating manufacturing. They're growing in wealth. We're shrinking in wealth. We are, you know, the old mall and they are the new mall. Now, I'm not saying we can't become the new mall, but I'm saying you gotta take your medicine to do that. And we're not doing that. Sometimes medicine is a teardown. And that's what we're doing now. We're trying to slowly tear down our economy. So I've grown very concerned in the last couple of weeks because, now I'm answering your question, because I don't see how it works. I feel like it's not snake oil. I'm not being lied to. I feel that they can't help but being optimistic on these ideas because under the surface, I think there's a panic starting to happen. I do.
A panic in who?
Well, Scott Bessent had an interview on Fox News, and he said something. I was already plugged into it, thankfully. One of the things, a panic in Scott Bessent. Now, he didn't say it, but I can hear spin that's completely not true. It's very nuanced, but I'll try and make it clear. One of the things we need to do is to stop people from selling our treasuries. So without getting into all the rabbit holes that I love to go down on those, one of the ways you do that is to encourage them to keep their treasuries. Well, how do you do that? How do you stop them de-dollarizing? They've already told us they don't want to own dollars because it could be confiscated. Plus, our banking is bad. Plus, our debt is bad. They don't want to lend us more money. How do you get them to retain treasuries? You don't. This is what Scott Bessent is doing. This is what we're doing. You do, and I really have only spoken about this to my audience, so I'm kind of sharing something with you that's very new, but you're going to be reading a lot. You're going to hear a lot about this down the road. We depend on other countries to lend us money to keep our standard of living, right? They don't want to lend us money anymore. So when a country no longer wants your money, your bonds for safety, when a country no longer wants to lend you money or buy your debt, what do you have to do? You have to give them equity. It's a debt for equity swap. So here's what I'm getting to with Bissett. Bissett comes on and he describes what I'm going to describe to you. He comes on and he says, well, what we're going to do is we're going to create a sovereign wealth fund. Well, it's kind of like a sovereign wealth fund. He had an interview with Kudlow. He said other countries, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Japan, Korea, parts of Europe, maybe Latin America, we're going to not encourage them to buy treasuries, although they will. We're going to encourage them to invest directly in the U.S. They're going to give us the money to build the factories. And I went, this is called foreign direct investment. This is, for your financial people, a debt to equity swap. I don't really think you're really safe anymore. So I want more upside, right? The safety of the treasury isn't really safe. So you have to address that. Secure the money, give them a lot of upside, give them a lot of kickers. And that's it. That's what he's doing. You don't want to take our debt. You want to take our upside. You want to basically buy us out. It's almost like a blowout, like a mafia thing. But Bissett comes on and he says this. Well, it's like we're running a sovereign wealth fund. They're going to give us money and we're going to tell them what to buy and they're going to buy it. Everyone's going to be happy. And I went, no, it's not like that. It's like you want to keep the Dodgers in your town. Okay. And so you say, you're not longer, we're going to build you a new stadium. You're going to buy equity in our companies. You're going to have a big control of our economy. We're going to buy the companies that you put money into, which is what we're doing. We are nationalizing industries partially as a sign to these other countries to invest money. And so I say, this is where I'm coming down on this. I say that there's a little bit of panic underneath the surface that's starting to come out. And that panic is we're running out of time. And if we don't get this money locked down in here, we're in trouble. And so I think we're starting to give away more than we should to be here. That's it.
Well, that's I heard that when it came out, and I think Kudlow said it sounds like an international shakedown or something close to that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that was the word. Usually something like that. Yeah.
So this idea that we're going to tell Japan, look, we're running a trade deficit with you. You have a trade surplus with us. And we're going to ask you, make you an offer you can't refuse. You got to plow that back in. But February 2022, didn't countries learn that if you get on the United States' bad side, we'll just change the rules on you? I mean,
no,
we're going to have to sweeten the pot here, wouldn't we?
Well, that's the point. It has to be sweetened a lot. I mean, let's just go with the facts as they've been presented, okay? Or as they've happened. The pot needs to be sweetened. The trust is at all-time highs, post-22, as you said. And then President Trump comes back from Saudis and he says, I've just cut a $600 billion deal of investment with them. And I think the number is too high, and I think the number is romanticized, but the idea is he's enticed them to get over, at least in part, their concerns for the moment. Tomorrow it may change, of their concerns about confiscation, of their concerns about security, by saying, I'll tell you what, we'll buy part of the companies that you buy, and I promise we won't nationalize, and we'll give you a 30% kicker on top. We're giving them guaranteed deals. It's like when you start a hedge fund. When you start a hedge fund, you get your first tenant, you get your first investor. Everyone gets 80%, and you get 20% as a manager. Your first investor gets 95% because you need him to get other people to come on board. And so the Saudis are like, all right, this is what we want. We want to make sure our money's safe. Give us a higher percentage to compensate for the risk. Give us a discount on rockets and missiles, or we'll buy China. We'll pump the oil. I mean, I feel like we're going to be giving away a lot. That's it. We have to give away a lot. We have to sweeten the pot greatly to encourage them to put their money in. We'll probably have to give them some legal contract that allows them to pull their money out, like a stable coin deal, which is what we're doing.
That's interesting. Well, speaking of one more potential cross current, I'm old enough to remember several bubbles. You should only have to live through one in your lifetime. But, you know, we had 2000, we had 2007, 2008, and all that. And here we are again. So by every measure, price to book, price to sales, price earnings, concentration, et cetera, these markets, these equity markets in the U.S. right now are not just sort of expensive, but the most expensive on record. So presuming this time isn't different, I don't really think a Fed rate cut's going to do anything at this stage. And against that backdrop, I'm seeing recession indicators, and against that backdrop, I'm also seeing the long bonds, Japan's 2-10s and 30s, 40s, all blowing out to the upside still. The gilts, the 30 years, you know, blowing out to the upside, yields going up. Germany, yields going up. U.S. 10-year, not coming down.
Right, right. Stable, so, but not good. Yeah, exactly.
Stable, but not headed in the right direction. It seems like the, I think I can understand the panic. It feels like there's a fuse lit here, looking at that data.
Just to touch on the other countries, yeah. I mean, the interest rates are going up in those other countries because they must permit inflation because they need to spend money, and they must let the bond yields go higher. And that puts pressure on us. If you're a dollar, if you're money and you say, I can get 5% there or 4% here, you're more likely to. So our rates have to go up. Our rates have to go up. All right. Just that's a tactical comment. But your comment about the bubble, I don't want to call a top, right? I mean, I'd love to call a top. I probably do all the time, but I never say it out loud. But I don't want to call a top, but the similarities, and people talk about similarities all the time, but I'll give you some real material similarities. I have a friend in commercial real estate, and he's an executive at a bank in the Philadelphia area, and he does a lot of commercial real estate, mostly on the mall side. And then he does a lot of high net worth individual housing, custom housing. So he's seen the best and worst in the last 3 years. You know, everyone wants a nice house away from the city. And then the other part is the office developments are collapsing. So he's seen both sides of it. And I showed him that chart that you and I were talking about before we went on the air. And I said, what do you think? Because it's commercial real estate, data centers. The chart is of the data centers are eclipsing regular office space. And I said, what do you think? And this is going to go to the bubble comment. He goes, well, didn't China, he tends to be snarky, but he's funny. He goes, didn't China really just kind of blow that idea out of the water with DeepSeek? Why are we spending all this money? He's like, Vince, this is my business. Why are we spending all this money on data centers? All it's going to take is one low-cost product, and our money is wasted. And we have, and then he said the word, he said, bubble. The DeepSeek concept, although no one's talking about it anymore, really kind of blew up the hole. If you throw more money at it, if you build it, they will come is what we're doing. And if you build it, they will come is what happened in 1999. And if you build it, housing, they will come in 2008. So the parallel is you have material instances of a narrowing market and a bubble growing here. You have overbuilding in one area that the market's dependent on. You have other areas that are slowing down. Housing is slowing. And you have a very narrow industry that's supposed to rescue us, and it's not. So to give you the parallels, 1999 and 2008, I looked at a chart that showed, I mean, if you're looking for the analog, 2007, 2008 stock market, we're on the same exact path, but we have almost a year to go. That's the chart. I'm not predicting that. But when you look at the similarities between 1999, 2008, and now, here's where they're similar. In 2007, 2008, when the Fed cut on September 18th, which was when we cut last year, the market made a new all-time high and then proceeded to collapse. During that time frame, long-term yields were creeping higher, which is what you said. Stocks were ignoring the long-term yields, and then eventually stocks said, okay, we care, and they collapsed. In 1999, long-term rates were creeping higher, and then eventually the competition for capital, cats.com wasn't working, or pets.com, and so all that washed out, right? Flight to quality. The quality was gold. Flight to safety, I should say. There's only one difference, and I swear to God they know this, and that's why they're doing it. It's energy. In 99, oil prices were going up. And the higher oil prices in combination with the higher rates killed stocks. And in 2007, 2008, that was right after the Beijing Olympics, and oil went to all-time highs then. And that also killed the market. Oil was at all-time highs. Long-term rates were climbing, and stocks were ignoring it, and falling out of bed. And we were all dependent on housing. And in 1999, we were all dependent on the dot-com concept. And here we are in 2025 and we're all dependent on a very narrow portion of the economy. So the missing link for you and I to call each other and say, let's get bearish, like tomorrow. I mean, it could happen tomorrow, but is when they, I think they have their foot on the throat of oil now. And when the price of oil goes up, then we have a problem. It's kind of like they used to put their foot on gold's throat. You know, as long as gold's not going up, we're okay. Now it's like, we don't care about gold. No one cares. As long as oil's low, we're okay. I think if you start to see oil really perk up, that you could, you have crash risk. That's it. That's where I am. The parallel's there. I'm just waiting for oil. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I agree, and I've talked about this a lot with my followers, the ceiling floor problem. So there's a floor below which we're not going to get oil exploration, and I submit to you we're already below that floor, right?
Yeah.
So we're seeing the rigs get stacked, the frac crews get stacked. I think it should even be going faster. I think that the companies haven't quite cottoned onto the discipline. They're kind of hoping that oil comes back. But there's a floor. We're either at it or just below it, but there you are. If it goes below this where we are now, if it goes to, say, 50, you're going to see all kinds of activity just stop, right? And then that exploration activity and drilling activity, which means future supply, goes down. Then there's a ceiling, and there's only so much the price of oil that debt markets like we have, like, you know, we have over $100 trillion in debt, can afford, right? So in July of 2008, one of the pins on that 08 issue was in July, oil going to $147 a barrel in 2008 dollars, right?
Right.
Pin in the bubble. So that, let's just say there's a ceiling, and I don't know how high that is, but I'm going to submit it's less than that. I think you get oil over 100, and people really struggle, you know, with
I agree. It doesn't have to go to 147 this time. It doesn't have to go that high. Yeah.
It doesn't have to go that high. So that's our ceiling floor, and that's getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And so the only way you escape that box, I guess, is, you know, I think people are penny, I could be wrong, but I think they're kind of counting on AI a little too much to save our bacon.
Yeah.
I think we're going to discover it's not quite as magnificent as we thought, or it has limitations. And, you know, the ChatGPT 5 model came out. Maybe Altman overhyped that a little bit, you know, but people are starting to figure this out. And then MIT just put that report out a couple days ago that said, oh, we looked at 300 companies using generative AI. 95% of them are failing at it in terms of it being revenue positive.
But it won't stop them from using it, Chris. What I mean is, AI, if I could just go like fundamental for you, because I know that this is your thing. AI is being promised as a top line creator. We're going to create more value, more sales, more new products. No. It's going to be a bottom line creator by firing people.
Yes.
And so if we get the recession that you're looking at, I saw a recent report, and we suspected, but it was nice to say it, that when an economy is doing well, a company will resist adopting new technology, doesn't want to fire people. Things are going well. It's not broke. Don't fix it. But as soon as you have a downturn, it's like, you know what? You're fired. I'm using the chatbot.
That's a good point.
And it's the downturn that causes the increase in unemployment. In a spiral type fashion. I did a whole piece on that. And the thing is, once there are two buyers of AI right now, well, the AI story is AI will create value. It's the iPhone, you know? No, it's not. It's a chatbot, and it's customer service, and it's a good customer service, but it also throws more responsibility on the user. It's the same thing as being on hold. Because it's constantly saying to you, can I do this for you? And I was like, shut up. Just give me the answer. I just want an answer. Anyway, so that's the story that everyone's love. If you build it, they will come. No. You and I have companies, and we're competing, you know? And this is what's going to happen. It's going to slow down. McMartinson and I'm McLancy. We're McDonald's competitors, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, things slow down. Pennies get pinched. And so you see me start to employ ChatGPT or an AI model to simplify it as my cash register. And what does it do? It allows me to keep my burgers at the same price because I'm reducing cost. So my bottom line maintains. And what are you going to do? Go out of business? you're going to start firing people. New technology proliferates in a downturn economically, not in an upturn. We haven't even begun. Goldman Sachs says, and it's conservative, Goldman Sachs says 6 to 8% of the workforce on the white-collar side is unemployed by AI relatively soon over the next 5 years. Now, they don't say it. They don't add to it, but they say if there's a downturn, it's worse. We're not going to say how much worse. And I can just imagine them wanting to put 10 or 12% and someone from the government going up and saying, don't say that. Just say 6 or 7. I can just...
Yep.
It's bad, man. It's bad. It's robots. The white-collar worker in the United States of America in a service economy is in the same position as the blue-collar worker at a union who was going to be replaced by robots two generations ago. The difference is they had a union to delay it, and white-collar workers don't have a union.
That's interesting, because I've been saying, you know, NAFTA stole the blue-collar jobs. AI is going to steal a lot of the white-collar jobs.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
And then what do you do? Well, I guess you go back to blue collar or something like that, you know. Honestly, you know, my advice to my son is go into the trades. Do it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, but who wants to work that way? So, but this is, I'm a fundamentalist, so I have this, I've been having this, not debate, just I'm turning this nut over and over again
right.
with people like you. I say, okay, let's imagine AI is all that and slice bread too. It's amazing.
Right.
But does AI sell products to other AI bots, right? You know, ultimately, the economy has to deliver something, right? So even if it creates a very efficient way of doing something that fires a lot of people,
okay.
We're back to that original Henry Ford quote, which is, I pay my workers $5 a day so they can buy my products. Who's going to buy all this efficient AI stuff, right?
That's where UBI comes in. You can't, you know... That's where UBI comes in. I don't need 50. Like, look, I'm a corporate lawyer. I'm not. But if it's, you're a corporate lawyer and you handle letters of intent. You handle these. Those things are gone. You don't need them anymore. They're gone. Goodbye. Right. You're done. Like the AI is the cure for bureaucracy.
Yes, it is. And I actually think that's a good thing, by the way, to be honest.
So do I. They're going to have to. Right now, they're figuring out other ways to make them not. Fire the bureaucrats. If I could tell you a story during COVID, do you mind?
No.
About the whole concept of how the government works with companies. During COVID, no one was working. Everyone was at home. And Starbucks was open. And I'm a big Starbucks person. Just that's one of my vices. And like it's me and the two baristas that are in there. Like no one's going in there. There's walking distance from where I live. And we're in the beginning, like we're in the middle of COVID, and there's a sign outside, like a something you'd see at a football game, a 3x12 sign. We're hiring. And I went in, I have nothing but time, right? I went in, you know, and I said, you're hiring. And I'm coming back every day trying to find the owner or the franchisee. And I said, are you really hiring? Or is that just like bullshit, you know? He's like, no, we're really hiring. I go, well, what are you doing? Well, we're hiring. I go, are you hiring full-time or part-time? And I go, we're hiring part-time. I go, well, are you hiring one or two? Or he's like, oh, no, we're hiring. All our places are hiring now. And I went, why? Everyone's getting paid $600 a week. Why? And, you know, that was the whole, when the stimulus checks were coming out. And he said, I mean, he's not at the higher level, but he said, we were told that it would be in our best interest. It sounds like I'm being a mobster. I don't mean to be that way. We were told it's in our best interest to not fire people and that the government would appreciate it if we hired people and there would be something for us on the back end. That was it. And the sign remained up all during COVID. And there were new people hired. And when COVID was over, the sign was pulled down. I went, holy shit. So I can. It's almost like, I mean, I'm signaling David Graeber's bullshit jobs book.
Yes,
it's
right.
It's almost like once robots were invented to replace the assembly line workers in the 70s, the powers that be got paranoid. What are we going to do with all these unemployed people? And they created bureaucracy for us to live under. And so what I'm going to wonder is, you know, how much more paperwork can we do when AI is doing it for us? I think we're going to have to have AI customers to keep it busy. Anyway, so I think the success of AI is deflationary because of the productivity and the fact that you fire all these people. But the success of AI, if it's permitted to happen in mass, is going to trigger UBI or something like it. And therefore, believing that the government can do what they want, therefore, they're going to control its implementation, and therefore, they're going to fight like hell to stop a recession. So do I think these things will happen? Yes. Do I think they'll happen as badly as they could? No, because I really think the government has all their eggs in one basket, AI, and they're watching the shit out of that basket. Excuse my French.
Yeah, well, but so either, though, these AI companies do generate all that beautiful top line, and then the government's going to have to take that because they're going to need that to pay the UBI for all the displacement on the bottom, or they're going to have to print up the difference.
Yes. And what am I supposed to say to that except, yep, you're right.
Yes.
I'll add some color.
Well, of the two, I doubt they're going to be successful in past. Well, I doubt. Let me finish the thought first, and I'll contradict myself. I doubt they're going to be of a mind to really tax the top line of all these AI companies as hard as possible, because these people have great lobbyists and all of that, right? But at the same time, let me contradict myself. I am, for the first time, and you're the right guy to talk to about this, seeing stuff I never thought I'd be seeing, which is my government taking stakes in the sales, offshore sales of companies, and equity positions in things like Intel. This is bizarre territory. I don't quite know how to parse it yet. What are you making of that?
So here you are. So, Chris, this is really interesting because you're talking about two things that can seemingly be disparate but have a big overlap in the middle. And on one hand, you're talking about we have to tax these companies' profits to subsidize the UBI or whatever it is, or the shortfall. And on the other hand, you're talking about we're taking stakes in our own companies or off-seas companies or what have you. And, you know, I already talked about taking stakes as part and parcel of us demonstrating to the other countries to invest in America, buy American. We're saying to them, buy American. But when you look at these two phenomena you're describing, how are we going to get more money out of companies and owning a piece of the companies? It's the same thing. It's a term called corporatism. And corporatism, without going down a political science rabbit hole, corporatism is the joint venture between the state and industry. If it goes bad to one side, it's fascism. If it goes bad to the other side, it's Stalinism. But if it can go bad very easily. So corporatism is, now we'll just, I'm making up, right? Corporatism is, okay, Amazon, I'm making it up. You just fired 20,000 people. We're going to have to raise your taxes because we need to make tax money to pay Social Security. These people are unemployed now. We got problems now, right? And Amazon says, okay, let's negotiate. And I believe, to my point, when your audience hears Microsoft say, we could fire 10,000 people with AI if we wanted to, that's not a threat. That's a negotiation with the government. Do you want us to not fire those 10,000 people? Then don't make us pay higher taxes. Give us a tax cut. I mean, I'm thinking about the negotiation. Do you want us, we can fire, look, do you want us to carry some dead wood for you? We'll carry some dead wood for you. Lower our tax rate. Give us a tax abatement. Build a new building for us. Build a new stadium for us, like we're the Dodgers. I believe that these concepts I'm talking about are no longer hypothetical. We're taking stakes in companies. We're directing foreign money into the companies that we take stakes in. And we're petrified that AI, as great as it could be, all that and a sliced bread is going to have an overlap where you have a changeover from people working, doing a job to people not working. And so it's like firing union employees. And they're not union employees at the white collar level. So how do you get them to not be fired? You give Amazon a deal. You create, sorry to say, more bullshit jobs. You know, it's like you keep the job. Yeah. You know, we need someone to clap erasers, you know, after school, that type of job, you know?
Yeah.
So, but here's the scary thing. The scary thing is that's what happened in the Soviet Union. That's right. What's happening, and that's a risk in China now. You know, as China's unemployment goes up, their productivity goes down. Why? Because they put more people sweeping the streets. And just, this is not a foreign concept to us. That's what Eisenhower did. During the Great Depression, let's say you had a machine that could clean streets. You know, one of those machines when we were kids, we'd see them drive. You don't use that machine. You park that machine, and you give 500 men brooms, and you say, sweep the street. You reduce productivity to increase work and animal spirits. At least they feel like they're doing something. And of course, you also prevent rioting because they're not in the streets rioting. I think we're going to decrease productivity to keep these people employed. And I think AI is the catalyst that's making us do it. That's it.
I'm worried as well. And the reason I'm worried, for the same reason for the Soviet thing, the Soviets tried to famously sort of direct the means of production, right? We need this much steel and that much wheat and,
yep,
you know, and of course the incentive structure was to, people being people, you know, it didn't work out, right? Because you need the invisible hand of the free market, all that stuff. So my concern is that because, you know, as Charlie Munger famously said, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. So great, our government takes a 10% stake in Intel. Well, now they have an incentive for Intel to do well or be the leader or something, and then they subtly are saying, hey, AMD, nice chipset you got there. Sure would be a shame if something happened to it, right?
Right.
But whatever, we're going to have bureaucrats or people with political interests now in political timescales and political ethos and sensibilities weighing in on where things go. I think that's a disaster. I'm a free market guy.
I'm sorry. I'm really optimistic on that, but I'm going to take your side for this moment, okay? When I look at the politicians who add pork to bills, who've been at the trough of not doing the right thing because, for whatever reason, they're worried about the next election, they're worried about their stock portfolio, like a Nancy Pelosi. And I see that those same people, that mindset, are now going to be influencing corporations in their decisions. You know, it's not just we bought Intel. It's we're controlling Intel and we're directing who Intel invests in now. I mean, it's complete infiltration of mediocrity. So either you have the corporations, which are run well, hand the government employees their asses because they just basically... They basically take the public money and don't give anything back. Or you've got the public servants, right, who are just doing the whole pork stuff at the corporate level. I'm a small L libertarian, okay? And I can even understand government involvement. And I can even say to you it's necessary. But I can't say to you it's necessary open-ended, and we're doing it open-ended. We're not saying it's a five-year hold. You know, even when the Fed bailed out banks, we're going to hold them for 5 years or hold them for 2 years. We're just buying it. We are. Can I zoom out a little bit, talk about China for a second here?
Please.
Of course. All right. One of the things, China is an authoritarian, to your point, state-controlled capitalist society. We are, ostensibly, a democratically governed, democratic republic governed capitalist society. Okay. For the last 50 years, the U.S. would go into countries, insert capitalism, and democracy would follow. Or we'd have a war. Insert capitalism, give people freedom of choice, they'll choose democracy. And we did that. And so we got many sections of the world to come to democracy by giving them capitalism. It's choice. More fries with that? Oh, I have a choice. And so you start to go democracy. And then comes China. And China says, there is no way you're doing democracy here, bro. And China says, we're going to do the capitalism thing. Russia screwed it up. Singapore got it right. Lee Kuan Yew. We're going to emulate his. This is like after Mao. Deng Xiaoping, he said, okay, he's learned from Singapore. And we're going to create this new kind of capitalism. It's capitalism. It's state controlled, but it's not anti-market. Now, if you like, oh, you can't have markets. And yes, you can. Markets existed before capitalism did. Like so, but the point is, China, despite the color wars, despite the prodding, despite everything, resisted becoming a democracy. And so you have authoritarian, state-controlled capitalism versus, let's call it, free market democratic capitalism. And we're trying to pull them to democracy. They're pulling us to authoritarianism and state-controlled work. And that's where we are. The world is flipping. We are nationalizing companies. And our country is moving towards their model. Their country is not moving towards our model. That's my concern.
I agree. And so DeepSeek was really, I thought, a seismic event, because it showed that this whole idea, we have these narratives, some of them are false. One of them is, oh, China just copies our stuff, right? And they don't. They've been clearly leading us in several dimensions for quite a while now. Right. And I could go through a whole laundry list of things, but AI is fundamentally a story of energy. And so here's one area I think China's just going to smoke us, is because they do have that authoritarian view, and they just say, listen, we're going to put in this new dam. It's going to be three times as large as Gorges Dam. Hey, you villagers, move, right? That's the end of the story. That's how that's going to happen.
And you
right?
villagers, move. Yeah.
This is the most important chart I've got right now, I think, which just shows the total terawatt hours of electricity. The United States starts here in 2000 at about 4,000. It's about 10% higher than that today. China crossed us at 4,000 terawatt hours in 2010. Slapped on another one entire United States worth of electricity generation in the next 10 years, and has done half of that again in the next 5 years. So if energy is the future, that's the future. They understand this very well.
And by the way, everything is energy. It's everything. Either kinetic or stored. Gold is stored energy, and oil is economic or kinetic energy. That's what you need. And, you know, just to make this really, this is like, I've been trying to wrap my head around some things here too. Just to make this real simple, to take it out of the abstract. Let's pretend that we and they are equal innovative geniuses. Let's pretend that we and they have equal money and resources. Okay, their stuff's already built.
Mm-hmm.
We had people dying in Texas in 23 from the freeze because of our power lines. We don't have the infrastructure. So while we were mocking, collectively, we're mocking the Chinese, oh, you have your city to nowhere, you overbuilt, it's empty, ghost towns. I mean, those were real things. Well, it wasn't just ghost towns, it's infrastructure that's needed. So like you said, they have a dam. Not only can they build the dam faster. Okay, maybe it's not a quality dam. I don't know. But all they have to do is say, you move to there. They don't have that pesky democracy to get in the way. It's very unifying as well when your whole nation is now on the same page and sees your progress. There's a nationalist pride there. So meanwhile, if you strip out all these abstractions that people like I like to think about, you have to lay the cable. We'll have the cable. And they have the cable. So if energy goes to zero in price, we still don't have the transmission cable. We don't, and they do. So how can we benefit from something we're not set up for yet? That's why you got all things like copper, I guess.
Well, that's why, you know, this whole idea that we're going to onshore manufacturing is a great thing to say. And I understand, I'm actually very sympathetic to the idea that the United States accidentally let go of some stuff it shouldn't have. Like right now, we do not make our own transformers, the most basic thing in the world for electricity production and distribution. We don't make them. The big ones are made in Germany and China. We don't make them. Well, let's say we wanted to start making them. Okay. Do we have guys who know how to make them? Do you just hire them on monster.com, right? How about the supply chains? What about all the circuitry, the components, the subcomponents, everything, right? So we don't even have the supply chains. All that kind of has to be built. That is actually, I think, where China is got the power. They have fully integrated supply chains, everything on site, right? Within the borders that they need.
They do. I can give you a real example of how China has evolved their supply chains over the years using silver and solar panels. It's a very easy one to understand, and it's very clear, especially on the precious metal side. You know, China, in the supply chain, they only had one part of the supply chain, the beginning of it where you pull it out of the ground, and the end of it where you put it on a ship. So they had the physical labor and the raw material. Everything in the middle they didn't have. That's the value part of the supply chain. So they would pull the metal out of the ground and they would sell it to someone else, and that person would make a solar panel, let's say. Well, over the years, they went from just doing the crap of just pulling it out of the ground to taking the dirt, filtering the silver out, refining the silver, next level. They don't have powder ability. You have to make it into a refined powder. They then send it over to Japan, and Japan has the machinery, the sensitive machinery, to make it into this very, very, very fine powder. And then they get the powder back, and they make it into a paste, and they add it to a solar panel, and they build it to a chip, and they add it to... And now they have the whole supply chain. So let's say there's $10,000 that can be made in a solar panel. They now are getting 9,000 of it. And so... the supply chain is owned by them. They own 85% of the silver supply chain. Now, I'll give you a real anecdote, a real example. And it's happening in commodities. And this is one of the reasons I think silver does explode, but it won't happen until it's too late. I'm not talking price here, but here's the concept. The supply chain, right? If you need to buy silver, as China has needed to buy silver for solar panels, whatever they do or not, I don't know, right? And you don't want to buy it at the market price, and you have... all this manufacturing capacity. Well, you go to the maker, the refiner, you go to the producer, so the miner of silver in Latin America. You already have your own silver spoken for. And you say, all right, we want to buy your raw silver. And the term for that is, one of the terms for that is concentrate. And concentrate is big bags of rocks with a high concentration of silver in it. That's all it is. But it needs refinement. And generally speaking, you as, you know, America, me as America, we call them up and we say, okay, we want to buy your concentrate, refine it for us and send it to us and charge us for the refinement. You know, it's kind of like, do you want undercoating on your car? So yeah, we want that. All right. And then send it to us and then we'll make it into coins to a mint or something like that. Well, this is the crazy part, not crazy, but this is the economics of it, to your point. China says, well, how much is the concentrate per pound? I'll make a number up. It's a dollar a pound. China says, we'll pay you $1.20. It's not silver. It's not on the market. The price of silver doesn't go up. And then I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm giving an example. This came from a miner with production in Latin America. China says, we'll pay you $1.20. I'm making the number up, but it's the idea. We're going to pay you, we're going to go over the top. I want to make sure I get the deal. And the Latin American company says, okay, fine. So will we find it? No. Don't refine it. Give it to us in the bags. We have manufacturing. We have the refinery already. So we're going to pay you more for raw material. We're going to keep our people employed, and we're keeping finished product out of the West hands. These supply chains, I'm not saying they can't be broken, but they're deep now, and they're based on the economics of it. I'm going in and I'm cleaning you out of all the Cabbage Patch Babies in 1985 before the rush comes. And so, God forbid, if we ever really need silver the way we really do need silver. So your comment about the supply chain, that's right. Belt and Road Initiative, that's a big deal. I mean, they're having problems. They're not out of the woods yet by any means, but strategically, they're better than almost everyone. Tactically, we're better, but we've been relying on tactics for so long that we don't have a plan. What's your plan? My plan is to trick them and then do something else. That's not a plan, you know? So the supply chain issue is a problem, and we need to rebuild those, you know, toot sweet. I talked to, one more thing. I talked to Copper, an example. I talked to Josh Fair. He's the CEO of Scottsdale Mint. And he was at a recent meeting because that's his industry. He goes, you know what? We're just figuring out. He says, the government is just, I don't want to put these words in his mouth, but his impression was the government is finally figuring out that we've been giving away our resources too cheap. Apparently, China has been buying our scrap copper, going around and buying it and taking it out. We're no longer exporting our scrap copper. So it's all, you know, or exporting it to them. Let's put it that way. It's all about, like you said, we let necessary industry be outsourced, and we thought we could solve it anytime soon, and we can't.
Well, I mean, these are big, giant, sweeping things. So, you know, kind of last question can be as long an answer as you've got time for. But as you look forward, what are you kind of expecting to unfold over the next 12 to 24 months, given all this?
Oh, yeah. Right, so I'll go with 24 months. This way it gives me more time to be wrong or right. in terms of stocks, I think they're being very vigilant and there'll be a controlled takedown, although I don't know how controlled the takedown will be, but I think there'll be more of a takedown. I think there's going to be more, governmentally, there's going to be more of a crackdown on outside information. The point being, remember when we heard all that stuff about DeepSeek?
Yep.
Have you heard anything else?
No.
It's because it's not getting allowed. There's an iron curtain. You know, like there's, I feel like we're behind a little bit of an information wall now. So I believe that information is going to be restricted more and more. I think gold will have a, I'm going to throw a number at you, but I don't mean it, but I'm going to throw a number. Gold can have a $300 drop and still be up another $500 by the end of the year, by the end of the 2 years, I should say. I think there's going to be a flood of money out of stocks into gold and Bitcoin because it's perceived as a safe haven away from stocks. And I'm looking for the collapse of oil to get long. I'm looking for that moment because if I don't get that moment, then I'm just going to short stocks because oil is going to go up and we're both going to be like, you've got to be crazy to be long stocks right now. If I do get that moment, instead of shorting stocks, I'll just buy oil. So my outlook for the next 2 years is silver. I'll give you some prices. Silver, I think silver $42 in the next 6 months. So let's say $46 to $52 in 24 months. I think gold could be in this range, no higher than $3,600 during that time frame. And I think stocks will crash from a much higher level. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we can crash it, but it's going to be at all-time highs. It's 5% off of all-time highs. So I think it's too important for us to... I think the reason I don't think stocks will crash, and this is not something I'm betting on, I don't have a lot of money in naked equities. I mean, I do, but not as much as I used to. We can't afford to have our pensions go under, you know, CalPERS and all those. We can't. That's more money. What is Trump doing now? He's letting pensions own. He's letting 401ks own private equity, crypto. I mean, he's deregulating everything so that people still have money to. I just feel like we're going all in on the bubble. Okay, we're going all in. We want the bubble. So by the time it's going to crash anyway, let's have a crash from a higher height. Trump is all in on the bubble. The expression is like the Jaws scene. We need a bigger boat. After Doge failed, Trump backed up like Roy Scheider in the movie and said, we need a bigger bubble. That's it. And so I'm not going to sell stocks. I'm going to buy oil at some point.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for your time today. We've been talking with Vince Lancey. You can find him at, that is VBL Goldfix, vblgoldfix.substack.com. That's his prime place there as well. You're on YouTube. And then also it's VBL's Ghost. It's at the Soren Tech, right? On Twitter?
Just say VBL's Ghost and it'll come up that way. But it's Soren the K. Yeah.
Soren the K. Yeah, that's
it. It's my backup name. My first one got banned.
So great. We'll put all those links down below. Follow Vince. He's got a great subscription service there if you're interested in gold and silver and also these macro things we've been talking about. Well worth subscribing to that. And I would highly recommend it. I do. So you should too. With that, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for making it so fun to tie together some ideas. I appreciate it. Thanks.